Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 30, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as you do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two guests lined up for tonight. Robin Hanel, who is a professor of economics at American University in Washington, D.C., speaking about his almost new book, Economic Justice and Democracy, From Competition to Cooperation, published a few months ago by Routledge, with a postscript by Noam Chomsky. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Peter Kwong, who is a co-author, along with, I'm sorry if I'm mangling the pronunciation of this name, Dusanka Mishevich, of the book Chinese America, The Untold Story of America's Oldest New Community, a big, fat history of Chinese people in the United States from the beginning to the present. And before we get to that, let's just look at a couple of the economic headlines. Earlier this week, the Federal Open Market Committee, the policy-making branch of the Federal Reserve Board, voted to raise its policy interest rate, that is the what's so-called federal funds rate, which is the rate at which banks lend each other money overnight. It's a very short-term interest rate, considered the most sensitive indicator of Federal Reserve policy. The 15th consecutive increase. They've just been one meeting after another. They meet every 6 weeks or so, and for 15 of these in a row, they've raised it by yet another quarter point now to 4.75%. This has been quite a substantial tightening, although interest rates remain low in absolute terms. They were 1% when the Federal Reserve started this policy of raising interest rates. At first, they said they were removing stimulus, but now they do seem to be a little worried that things are getting just a little too good, the unemployment rate getting a little too low, wages rising a little too quickly, and they want to put an end to that. Will they create an outright recession? Well, we don't really know, but most of the time that the Federal Reserve has gone on one of these extended tightening jags, they have ended only when the unemployment rate rises significantly and other economic indicators turn down. So we'll see if they can fine-tune this one to their heart's content, but the historical precedent would suggest that they want a substantial slowdown, a higher unemployment rate, and slower wage increases, which haven't been all that great. This has not been a very jobful recovery. Wages have not been growing, but things just haven't been hard enough on the working class, apparently, for the Federal Reserve. The housing market, also probably one of the Fed's targets. They have been concerned, although discreetly, they haven't been saying too much about it publicly, but one can only guess that privately they were concerned that the housing market has been in a dangerous bubble for the last couple of years. That bubble does seem to be deflating. I mentioned last week that sales of existing houses were unexpectedly up in the month of February. The sales of new houses, which are generally considered to be a little more contemporary, an indicator of what's going on, that was down quite sharply. Year-to-year, 13%, 10% month-to-month decline from January to February. Quite a sharp decline, and continuing a trend that was established last summer of a softening housing market. Similarly, the Mortgage Bankers Association's tally of applications for new mortgages and refinancings has been also in a downtrend since last summer. Ticked up a little bit last week, but the trend has been down now for the better part of a year. So the housing bubble does seem to be losing some air. American consumers, though, looking rather upbeat. The Conference Board reporting that its measure of consumer confidence rose quite strongly in the month of March, led mostly by expectations for the future. Not so much present evaluation of the present was up, but the expectation for the future was up much more sharply. Americans, of course, inveterate optimists. Also, some considerable evidence that the job market is looking better. Now, 28.4% of Americans, at least in this survey, reporting that jobs are plentiful, and 20.7% reporting them hard to get. That's a difference of 8 percentage points. Just November of last year, hard to get exceeded jobs plentiful by more than 2 percentage points. So that's a swing of 10 points in the last 6 months or so. It does look like, at least by this measure, that the job market is improving somewhat. We shall see on next next week, a week from tomorrow, what happened with employment in the month of March. But it does look like it has been picking up. The weekly tally of measure of consumer attitudes from the ABC News and the Washington Post, up a point last week, also has been edging higher for last since February. And well off its lows that were clocked in the paroxysm of national despair after Hurricane Katrina. So that measure of consumer attitudes also popping up. Last week's tally of initial jobless claims, the number of people who lost their job and went over to sign up for benefits for the first time, that was off 10,000 last week, following a decline of 7,000 the week before. That had been wiggling a little higher for the last few weeks, so this is a substantial decline after three consecutive weeks of increase. It is looking, the job market looking a little better by this measure as well. However, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, their measure of or forecast of where the economy is going 3 to 6 to 9 months out, is still positive, but has been easing considerably. It peaked in February and has been falling practically every week ever since. So that does suggest a slowdown in the economy later this year, with the housing market slowing, the Federal Reserve pushing interest rates higher. That is not at all a surprising development. We shall see what happens as the weeks and months go on. And then finally, in U.S. economic news, bankruptcy filings the fourth quarter of last year up a stunning 80% from the previous year, following a 37% increase in the third quarter of last year. This is a combination of high debt levels, certainly the fundamental factor driving this, but the timing of it was greatly increased by the change in the bankruptcy law, the tightening in the bankruptcy law that took effect, I think it was October 17th. So a lot of bankruptcy filings in the first weeks of October, no doubt. We shall see if this continues into the first quarter of this year, but a remarkably high number of personal bankruptcies, 654,000 people filing in the fourth quarter of last year. Business bankruptcies actually also up as well, and that... probably not entirely the result of the change in the law, but people are just heavily in debt, and the bankruptcy law is getting considerably less friendly. And as I often say, if you have a lot of debt, please do consult a lawyer about the possibilities of filing for bankruptcy. The consequences are not as severe as you might imagine, and it is a way to get out of odious debts. And then finally, the Inter-American Development Bank reporting that remittances to Latin America and the Caribbean reaching a record $54 billion in 2005. That is people who work abroad and send cash back to their homes in Latin America and the Caribbean. That was up 17% for the previous year, and this quite a strong number. Some 25 million Latin American Caribbean-born adults reside outside their countries of origin. About two-thirds of them send money home on a regular basis, usually wiring between $100 and $300 at a time. Over the past decade, the Inter-American Development Bank reports, these transactions have snowballed to the point where they far exceed overseas development assistance provided by what are called donor nations, which is a rather generous term for what usually involves the extension of debt, and international organizations of Latin America and the Caribbean. Mexico, the leading recipient, expatriates sending more than $20 billion home last year. This cash, very important to the individuals who are in the receiving end, but also to the national economies that need the inflow of cash. So let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to talk to Robin Hunnell. That a little excerpt from Anton Webern's Five Pieces for Orchestra. That is the first piece performed by Antal Doughty and the London Symphony Orchestra. We'll hear the other four of those five pieces, all quite short. The whole thing accumulates to about 4 minutes. Anton Webern liked to keep things brief. We'll be hearing that the rest of the program. And now, do we have Robin Hennell on the line? We have Robin Hennell on the line. Welcome to WBAI, Robin.
Well, good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. I should say your book, Economic Justice and Democracy, From Competition to Cooperation, was recently published. It's not brand spanking new, but we're not fetishists for novelty here on Behind the News, by Routledge. People often ask me when I comment on the economy, so what would you do, wise guy? How would you do things better? It's much easier to be a critic. You've actually taken a leap into examining post-capitalist possibilities. So I have to, first of all, admire your nerve for doing that. It's a thankless and risky task, but somebody has to do it. I'm glad you did.
Well, and apparently even Monthly Review recently is slowly coming around to the position that it is important to say more on that subject than the movement has tended to say in the past. So, yeah.
A lot of us have always clung to Marx's famous comment that it's not his job to write recipes for cookshops of the future. And I know I've read that several times in Monthly Review over the years.
Yes, I have too. I have too. But then Marx was writing quite a while ago, so maybe it's more appropriate now. And actually, that's one of the things I argue in the third part of the book, that at this point, we have a credibility problem. Anti-capitalists have a credibility problem. That is, we've claimed all along we have a better idea, but at least in some cases, what we delivered didn't seem to be that much better. I don't want to quibble over, but it certainly wasn't something that, to write home about. So, in light of that, I think it's more important than it ever was for anti-capitalists to clarify sort of, we have to improve the quality of our own thinking in order to, be credible to those that we talk to, that we really do have very good ideas about how to improve on capitalism in fundamental ways.
All right, I'm going to start by playing the role of what William Blake called the idiot questioner. I'm not going to ask you to spend a lot of time on this, but, everyone now, even a lot of people on the left, have just sort of resigned themselves to the fact that capitalism is here to stay. It's won. The anti-capitalists have lost. It may be a flawed system, but it's the best we can do in an imperfect world. What's your response to that kind of argument?
Well, I mean, what's undoubtedly true is that capitalism is more firmly in the saddle and more triumphant now than I think at any point in the 20th century. But I think that is mostly a sad commentary on, those of us, who argued against what I call the economics of competition and greed and argued for and tried to build movements that would allow us to establish an economics of equitable cooperation. I think it's mostly our failures. It's certainly not that capitalism is, producing brilliant successes, particularly the neoliberal, resurgence of neoliberal capitalism. There was what was called the golden age of capitalism in the aftermath of World War II, which I think was largely responsible to the strength of social democratic reform movements. In the United States, that's sort of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, the New Deal. But that really, now for the past 20 to 30 years, we've had a, much more vicious and destructive version of capitalism. Growing income inequalities, environmental destruction, the kind of wastage that goes on with sort of global financial crises. Capitalism certainly isn't proving successful. It's just that its opponents, at this point, are very weak.
Well, remaining in my idiot questioner mode for a little while longer, a lot of people will say, well, God, look at Europe, 10% unemployment, riots in France a few months ago because of mass unemployment and exclusion. The American model, for all its problems, does generate lots of employment, and we don't have people rioting here for burning cars for sport or for freedom to express their discontent with the society. What Europe really needs to do is be more like us, and the stagnant state of the European economy shows that even social democracy is a fossil these days.
That's certainly what the you know, the proponents of neoliberal globalization and the American version of free market and freewheeling capitalism. It's not really free market, but it's freewheeling, would like the world to believe. And it's certainly the case that, you know, we have succeeded in sort of imposing that model to some extent on Europe. My read of the French situation, and I don't claim to be an expert on, you know, French politics, but I feel delighted that in France you see a strong reaction against what it is that the, if you want to call it the American or neoliberal version of capitalism for the 20th century, actually delivers to the populace of countries like France. I think that what you're seeing there is a rather incoherent but a very firm statement: we don't like what you are doing to us. And that is, you know, that's what you're seeing in the streets of France. I think there are places in the world, particularly Latin America right now, where I like to say that in my lifetime, I never remember when the political situation was, you know, was more discouraging than it is here in the United States right now during the Bush period. I'm 60 years old. I don't vividly remember the McCarthy period, so I'm not thinking of that. On the other hand, I've followed Latin American politics very, very closely my whole life, and I can't ever remember a time when sort of things were more promising in Latin America as a whole. And there you see a very strong and increasingly coherent populist, yes, but nonetheless an increasingly coherent and strong reaction against neoliberal globalization and the neoliberal model of capitalism. So I think that in some ways I think the neoliberal model has passed its peak in terms of its, you know, sway on the world, and that we may, you know, now be sort of riding a wave of reaction.
And one of the encouraging things about Latin America is that the breadth of it, there's a great breadth and variety to what's happening down there in its resistance to neoliberalism. We don't know where it's going to go, but it does seem that things are on the move.
And it's particularly encouraging that it's not isolated to one country where, you know, if it were isolated to one country, it becomes very difficult. It makes it much easier for U.S. to sort of isolate that regime and sort of pick them off. But the movement is so strong in so many Latin American countries right now, and this is even prior to the next Mexican election. We may actually get a boost at least in the right direction, you know, in another major player in Latin America. So I'm very hopeful there. And when I look to see where are people actually moving strongly and successfully to oppose the economics of competition and greed and start to build the sort of economics of equitable cooperation, I see a lot of that happening in Latin America. I just hope that we can, at some point, we have to be able to create that kind of a movement here in the United States, too.
I was speaking with Robin Hanel, who is the author of Economic Justice and Democracy, From Competition to Cooperation, published by Routledge. And I should say that the book has a blurb from me on the back cover.
Yes, I thank you for that.
And I'm not profiting from that blurb in any way, just to for full disclosure.
Well, and you did not say you endorsed every idea in there. You just found it very intriguing, which I think is all a good book can do.
Yes, as I say.
If it keeps you interested, it's not supposed to sell you on every point.
It will make you think, and how many books make you do that, quoting myself. You review some of the alternatives to capitalism that have come up in the past. And, of course, there's Soviet-style socialism or quasi-socialism, which I guess is really pretty much a dead letter these days, so it's really not worth spending an awful lot of time talking about right now. But
maybe we could say maybe the dustbins of history.
Yes, but social democracy is still alive in some countries and still alive as an option in some people's minds. So what's your beef with actually existing or even slightly phantasmic social democracy?
Well, I have a chapter on social democracy. I also have a chapter on libertarian socialism. And my goal in both cases was, you know, not to provide the definitive analysis or write the definitive history of social democracy or libertarian socialism in the 20th century. I mean, I'm not a historian, and that can be a weakness, too, when you're writing a book. But I was looking for what are the lessons to be learned about both the strengths that the social democratic movement displayed in the 20th century. What are the positive lessons to learn from social democracy? And what are the negative lessons that we now we need to take advantage of the benefits of hindsight. And I thought that it was important to apply the same kind of analysis to libertarian socialism. What were the strengths of libertarian socialists in the 20th century, and what were the weaknesses? And, you know, to make a long story short, I thought that, you know, when you're giving credit where credit is due, that the social democrats, in many ways, were, you know, the champions of what I call reform organizing. On the other hand, they made the critical mistake of essentially becoming handmaidens to capitalism and not sticking with a conviction that you can reform capitalism and make it more palatable. You know, you can improve the lives of the victims within capitalist system, but as long as you have a system that's, you know, based on private enterprise and driven by market forces, there's only so far you can go in the direction of delivering economic justice, economic democracy, much less environmental sustainability.
Well, to an American,
the essential failure of social democracy in the 20th century is that it lost that insight, and in its organizing, it basically lost those themes.
But to an American, a world where we had universal health insurance, good income supports and retraining and job creation for the unemployed, free tuition at colleges, that would almost seem like utopiahood.
Well, yes, and people argue that Sweden and the Scandinavian economies in general had moved had moved a great deal of the distance in that direction, you know, by the 1970s. Distance in that direction is wonderful, and when you compare it to, you know, the kind of vicious blame the victim, end welfare as we know it type of, you know, capitalism we have here in the United States over the past 20 years, it is a tremendous improvement, and that's why it's simply false for those of us who are anti-capitalist to say, you know, all capitalism is created equal. There's no lesser evil. If it's capitalist, it's capitalist. But one of the problems with social democracy is those reforms, as long as you leave the fundamental institutions of private enterprise and market forces, you know, in place, then you always are risking that those reforms will be rolled back. And we have seen that happen in those Scandinavian societies. So that's another reason that at some point you have to go beyond the reforms, because they will always be temporary and very, very vulnerable if you do not sort of succeed, you know, if you do not push farther. My reading on libertarian socialism, I guess I've discovered in the last year going around and giving talks to different groups. When I talk to social democratic groups, they're always very happy about my sort of criticisms of libertarian socialists, who I consider myself a libertarian socialist. So the social democrats are very receptive to my criticisms of libertarian socialism and, you know, prickly when I talk about criticisms of social democrats. And the same happens in reverse with libertarian socialists. I think that
Among friends here, so you can say whatever you want.
Okay. My basic reading on libertarian socialism in the 20th century is its major strength was recognizing that there is a desirable alternative to capitalism. It's one in which people actually manage their own economic activities cooperatively, and they do it through democratic councils of workers and consumers, and that people are capable of managing their own economic lives in fair, efficient, and democratic ways. That conviction that libertarian socialists just never have given up on, I think, is both true and a fundamental strength. I think that after the early part of the century, libertarian socialists basically had an attitude about reform organizing that was isolating and self-defeating. And the major problem libertarian socialists have to overcome is how to engage in reform organizing and commit themselves to reform organizing in an era when that's the only way that you are going to be able to come into contact with and work with large groups of people and therefore build a democratic movement.
Well, your vision is an economy that in which people participatory planning. People run their enterprises, plan consumption, all democratically, collectively, openly.
Yes, because I think that's the only way we will eventually achieve the goals of economic justice, democracy, and sustainability.
How do we get there from here?
Yes, and in the past, I've never really written on what I always considered to be the most difficult subject, and that is, well, if this is a good idea, how do you get from here to there? How do you get from competition and greed, which is pervasive in the economies of today's world?
And it's also in our heads, right?
And it's in our heads, that's right. It's in our heads, and it's dominant, and it's ever-present. And how do you begin to move away from that, you know, toward an economics of equitable cooperation? And my major suggestion in the last part of the book comes down to this. We have to combine much more aggressive and much more intelligent work in both economic reform campaigns and the major economic reform movements. We have to work much more wholeheartedly to build the labor movement, the anti-corporate movement, the consumer movement, a poor people's movement, anti-globalization, global justice movement, whatever name you want to give it to. All those movements are going to have to be much larger and more powerful than they are today, and that means we have to build them. But at the same time, if that's all we do, I don't see why we would expect to end up in any different situation at the end of the 21st century than social democrats and sort of reformers did at the end of the 20th century, which is not in a very good situation. I think you have to combine that kind of reform work with what I call building experiments in equitable cooperation right in the middle of capitalism. The analogy is this. If people can think back to the days of national liberation movements in the Third World after World War II, many of those movements established liberated territories where they basically, during their struggle, started practicing sort of the new society that was training cadre, that was training people to think and behave in different ways. All of that was going on in liberated territories at the same time that they were engaged in sort of frontal struggles, for their national liberation revolutions. We have to do something analogous, which I think is actually much more difficult and tricky. We have to build those experiments in equitable cooperation right in the geographical and social middle of capitalism. And that's not easy. And it's a mistake to think that if we exclusively devoted our attention to those kinds of things. I'm talking about everything from producer cooperatives to consumer cooperatives to egalitarian living communities. Some people, you know, are very excited about local currency systems. I'm not. I think you probably aren't either. All of those kinds of things are important to engage in along with reform work. But you can't limit yourself to those things because they have to grow in capitalism, and that's difficult.
Well, we've only got about a minute left in this segment, so let me ask you this. It seems to me that the American people do not have a great longing for a systemic overhaul, whether out of resignation or active assent with the status quo. Are we missing something? Is there a great deal of discontent bubbling under the surface, or is what looks to be consent with in capitalist order, is that really the order of the day?
Inside the United States?
Inside the United States, yes.
Well, I think that, I mean, the critical issue, what dominates politics inside the United States is you have a very solidly organized right wing that's firmly in control of the entire government apparatus. You have a very weak and almost dissolving Democratic Party before your eyes. And you have, you know, a solid third of the country that from the very beginning of the Bush administration, you know, has never been more angry, disgusted, and, you know, and fundamentally opposed to everything that's going on in terms of policy in my lifetime. Expanding that third and giving that third sort of more power and voice, you know, I think is the task in the near future.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Robin Hanel. Robin Hanel, author of the book Economic Justice and Democracy, From Competition to Cooperation, published by Routledge. And he's also a professor of economics at American University in Washington. And let's take a little break, and we'll be back to talk with Peter Kwong. that the second and third of the five pieces for orchestra by Anton Webern, performed by the London Symphony under Anton Dorati. A little change of pace from the usual musical fare on Behind the News. And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM on your radio dial, and on the web at WBAI.org. And I'm going to start a new feature of Behind the News sometime in the next few weeks. I'd like you to, if you want to ask any kinds of, I think Ask the Economist is I think the Financial Times is using that as a regular weekend column. So if you want to ask any kinds of questions about economics or even suggest segments, but just sort of a Q&A kind of thing as well, please do email me at dhenwood, D-H-E-N-W-O-O-D, at panix, panix.com. That's dhenwood at panix.com. And now we're joined in the studio by Robin Hanel, who is, no, we're not. We're joined in the studio by Peter Kwong. I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong book. Peter is the co-author, along with Jasanka Miscevich, of Chinese America, The Untold Story of America's Oldest New Community, the definitive and large-scale history of the Chinese people in the United States, published relatively recently by the New Press. Welcome to the studio, Peter.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, the Chinese started arriving rather slowly in the 19th century for a while. There were just a few here. So tell us the history of how they first started coming and where they came from.
Well, the first big group that came to the United States, of course, because the gold rush on the West Coast. But even before that, there were a lot of people coming through New York City in the 1840s, because New York was the biggest port in the United States, and there are all kinds of people coming through here, and some of them stranded here. And in fact, New York City had about 50 Chinese living in Lower Manhattan around the time of 1850, just about the time that the Chinese came from the West, coming into the West Coast for the gold rush.
And where did they come from in China? Any particular place?
Well, most of them actually came from Guangdong province. Not only Guangdong province, but specifically from six counties outside of the city of Canton. Canton was an international port for almost 1,000 years. So it was the exclusive trading port for foreigners who wants to trade with China. So for a long time, Europeans and Arabs and Southeast Asians coming to China, and they end up in the port of Canton. And they buy tea, they buy porcelain, they buy all kinds of things, silk and stuff. And what happened is that those produce that is sold to the people come actually produced locally. And eventually, all this work is farmed out in these neighboring villages. And then came the Opium War, that the whole economy collapsed. And the people who had engaged in this kind of commercial economy through this international trade decided to leave. And many of them came to United States. Some went to Australia. Other went to Southeast Asia.
Yeah, they're Chinese all over the world. When did the Chinese diaspora really spread out?
Well, the Chinese diaspora spread out quite early because in the 14th, 15th century, there were actually quite a bit of commercial trade, commerce that the Chinese carrying out. They, you know, they have fleets of boats that went out to the oceans. And in fact, the story that that British writer claimed that that the Chinese might have discovered United States before the North America before the, but in any event, so
that doesn't count.
but in any event, Chinese were actually a trading people until the Ming Dynasty. The imperial household felt threatened by these merchants. They were trading with overseas and making money, and they thought this kind of merchants will undermine their power, and so therefore they cut it off.
When was that?
That was 1600s, and so there was an embargo stopping Chinese from leaving China until, of course, the Opium War came. Chinese no longer able to control its population. And that was exactly the same time the slave trade ended, and there was a tremendous need to have obliging labor to replace the decreasing number of slaves, African-American slaves. Yep. So this is the context where the migration began to pour out.
At first, before the Civil War, the Chinese who were here were treated rather well and with some respect, right?
Well, they were mainly they were yes and no, to the extent that many of them came to this place where pretty much there's nobody there. So as long as they don't compete with the whites for mining rights, it was okay. In fact, most Chinese who initially came to the United States came for the gold rush. They didn't go to the gold mines. They actually decided that there was such shortage of female labor at the point. There are a lot of service work needed to be done. In fact, in San Francisco,
people are shipping their laundry off to Hawaii.
Exactly,
that was remarkable to learn that people
All these gold miner from the East Coast, they all male.
They couldn't find a woman to wash a shirt, right?
So Chinese developed. Now, there's other things. For instance, these gold miners came to San Francisco. There were no houses, so in fact, the prefabricated houses were built in Canton and shipped to the United States, to fulfill that need. So. Chinese were actually really very much engaged in all aspects of the West Coast economy at the very beginning. Although there's, because later exclusion forced them out, and we don't recall a very little record of this kind of diverse participation of Chinese in the American economy.
The building of the Transcontinental Railroad really brought Chinese workers into conflict with white workers. Could you tell the story of the Chinese and the railroad?
What happened was after the Civil War, there was tremendous need for labor, and particularly on the West Coast. West Coast developed, and the problem the white employers found is that any whites or worthy anything would not be doing the kind of work, such as building railroads. If you find somebody, railroad company wanting to look for disciplined workers, they're not whites because...
Yeah, the white guys would work a few days, get a paycheck, get drunk,
exactly,
and disappear. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's so many opportunities. So eventually end up deciding, well, the Chinese could do it. And so, in fact, the Chinese really contribute to the completion of the railroad. Once it's completed, the whole idea is, now the whole place is we have the railroad. Then we need to develop that whole area, the farming and all that stuff. So there was a tremendous desire to bring in Chinese labor. We, in fact, signed a treaty with China it's called the Burlingame Treaty, 1868. Basically, the agreement is that both countries will allow their own people travel to the other countries. And from our point of view, we would want the Chinese government to allow these labor to come here. Now, this was considered a liberal policy, a treaty. A lot of people say, well, this is, but there's one thing about that treaty which is very intriguing. It says, whereas you could come here, they should be protective, but that the Chinese cannot become naturalized. Now, during that period of time, United States—
And the children born here were not then citizens either?
That was the 13th Amendment. That's a different issue. But in other words, if you come here, if you come from Europe, there's no question of become naturalized. All right? But they specifically pointed out the Chinese cannot. All right? The reason being that this, I would submit, was Americans' attempt for the guest workers program. In other words, the employers basically figure that, we want these people to come, but we don't want them to stay here forever. And then the image is somehow the Chinese don't bring their wives anyway, they would go back home. But the labor looked at this and understood several things. First of all, the treaty allowed the Chinese to come in as contract labor. At the same time, that treat them as what's called alien, not eligible for citizenship. And so this was the perfect design for the employers. You could come here, you could work, but you don't have any citizenship rights, you don't have any labor protections. And at that time, the labor movement understood what it meant and objected to it. Now, the problem, however, instead of objecting to it from the point of view, well, these are workers too, that you should, we should...
Potential allies.
And they, in turn, turn around and accusing the Chinese as a willing conspirator to undermine their labor conditions.
It seems like anti-Chinese agitation is one of the foundations of the American labor movement.
Exactly. That was the very beginning of the emergence of Chinese labor. Of course, fight against African-Americans, the same thing. In other words, African-Americans, you can't include them in a labor movement because they're slaves. And in the case of Chinese, they were coolies. Coolies are almost as bad as slaves. So we can't compete with these people. Instead of saying, let's free them from the coolie-dom, we say, we don't want them. So it was a very, very significant historical point of American labor history as well as American immigration history.
I'm speaking with Peter Kwong, who is a professor at Hunter College in the CUNY Grad Center and also author, co-author of the book Chinese America, out from the New Press. How did Chinese figure in the evolving system of race in the 19th century?
Well, it's very interesting because when during the American independence, there were hardly any Chinese. The only racial things they understood was black and Native Americans. And in fact, they heard about Chinese, but never seen any Chinese. In fact, George Washington, until somebody pointed out to him, he thought Chinese were white. So the idea of this whiteness actually evolved. And so the biggest color group of people came in that were undermined this was, in fact, the Chinese. Chinese came in 1850s and came in by the time Civil War, there were about 30,000 Chinese. Now, but the 30,000 Chinese was very, very important. In fact, after the Civil War, the discussions of who should be eligible for citizenship and the point was, before that, you have whites, but after the Civil War, was the inclusion of blacks. So a lot of people basically said, well, you know, if you're born in the United States, you should be eligible for citizenship. And lo and behold, there were all these senators. In fact, senators from New York and Pennsylvania says you can't do that. If you do that, Chinese will come in the millions. And then we'll swamp our country, and they will overrun our country. So even though there's so few Chinese, but the image of Chinese as a threat was already beginning, even before the large-scale Chinese immigration come in after the construction of the railroads.
The reaction of white workers against Chinese,
yep.
How much of this came spontaneously from the workers themselves? How much of it was manipulated by bosses, or was it a mix of these things?
It's a mix of things. Every group has its own. The bosses basically set up a situation, all right, to give excuse for antagonism, all right, basically treating the white workers differently from Asian worker. So you're paid differently, and also the way they structure your labor differently. The white employers prefer the Chinese come work under Chinese subcontractors. So the image was somehow, you know, the Chinese, this is America. How come they come in and they only work with each other? So this becomes the excuses for the American labor to be hostile towards them. The American labor's problem was the whole the whole idea of white privilege. Somehow, you know, these are colored people, that they shouldn't have the right to come to this country to work. And so that was the call for exclusion of Chinese.
And then the Chinese were legally excluded, the Chinese Exclusion Act. When did that happen?
1882.
And for how long?
Well, the law was not repealed until 1943. That happens to be during World War II, United States needed China to be an ally. And at that time, you probably know that Chiang Kai-shek was our ally. And and he was a reluctant ally in the sense that American war effort was mainly engaged in Europe. And even though China was our ally, we didn't give that much aid at the beginning of the war to Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek says, you know, you're not going to give me more weapons. I'm going to negotiate with Japanese. So under this kind of a condition, the United States says we have to do something significant to it. One of the things was repeal the exclusion against Chinese.
What was life like for Chinese Americans during that period of exclusion?
Well, it was a very, very difficult period. In other words, they are considered as aliens, ineligible for citizenship. Therefore, there are all kinds of facilities not available, all kind of jobs not available for them. Some cities you cannot open up a business because you're alien. Certain professions not available. But then, of course, on top of all is whole plain, simple discrimination. And in fact, physical, mental torment of these Chinese population in the United States.
But then World War II turned out to be pretty good for the Chinese Americans.
Ironically, yeah. Because they wanted we wanted China to be our ally, and this is where the history, American history, tend to be is that the idea of identifying our minority with the country they originally come from. So, so for instance, during World War II, China was our allies. All of a sudden, we decided Chinese were great people. They are brave people.
And there were good jobs in the war machine, too.
That's right. They were able to get. In the meantime, of course, Japanese Americans, majority of them, or overwhelming majority of them, were born in the United States. Well, because they're Japanese. Even though, so they were put in internment. So this is the connections between ethnic minority and is a constant threat. We see this again recently, the hostility towards China because China is a threat, and then we have recent events such as the scandal, Clinton's financial. Fundraising scandal.
Oh, Charlie and Tree. And,
that's right. Yeah, you know. And then Wen Ho Lee, somebody who's from Taiwan, was accused of somehow aiding a spy working for mainland China.
Yeah, that was a hideous period. Yeah. But for the most part now, you know, we think of Chinese as the so-called, the proverbial model minority.
That's right.
High incomes.
That's right.
Love education, disciplined, obey the laws, you know, just in general.
That's the new image.
Really great people. What do you make of that?
Well, this is, again, need to be clarified historically. Previous Chinese Americans were mainly working class and treated as such. And then 1950 onwards, a lot of Chinese students stay in the United States, came to the United States. At that time, too, we needed professionals, and we couldn't get it from Europe. We decided to naturalize a lot of them. So 1960.
So when were Chinese finally allowed to become citizens?
Excuse me?
When were Chinese finally allowed to become citizens?
Exclusion Act allowed them to become the repealed Exclusion Act allowed them in 1943. But the quota at that time was 105. All right. Now 1952, we have Immigration Act, which is raised in every other aspect, but there's a provision allowing people with professional skills to come in, and that one did not identify race. And originally they thought, you know, all scientists have to come from Europe, but a lot of Europeans didn't come. So as it turned out, a lot of foreign students were here, and it was during that time also. The communists took over mainland China. A lot of people didn't want back. The Chinese foreign student didn't go back. So that was the beginning of a different kind of Chinese, a different kind of Chinese who were educated, who actually the cream of the crop of Chinese education system. They spoke English, and I call them the uptown Chinese. Then 1965, new immigration law gave a larger percentage of this kind of people to come in. So from that point on, we have a bipolar Chinese community. One group is relatives, the old Chinese, who were of rural origins, who do not speak English very well. And then you have the professional Chinese who actually, most of them had to have been graduated from college and had to be good enough to come to American universities. And a lot of times, because Chinese was so poor at that time, they had to have a scholarship. So in other words, you're talking about the cream of the crop in Chinese education system. When they come to this country, they way above the average American college graduates. And when they get a graduate degree, a PhD, and then they could go straight into jobs working for IBM or these high-tech companies and moving right into the upper-middle-class suburban neighborhoods.
But we've also had, in recent decades, a whole new influx of new immigrants from China, many of them just up the street from where we're sitting
right now.
What's life like for them? It's in many ways a throwback to the old days.
Well, actually, it's a throwback in the sense that they are the working-class people, mainly. Again, without skills, without language. But this time, however, most of them came in as illegals. And in addition to that, they came through smuggling networks, which means they have to pay. Today, it's about $55,000. So just imagine somebody come to this country without skills, without language ability, having to work in very, very low-skilled jobs, and then have to pay for the first 3 or 4 years to pay off the debts. So this is a very large, significant population coming to United States since the 1990s. And employers know about this and target these people for special exploitation. So I would say the conditions of these people were not that much better than the 19th century Chinese. They don't have status, and they have to pay. It's almost a virtual indentured servitude kind of systems.
Finally, we've only got a minute or so left, but what China now, in the American imagination, is in many ways where we admire the economic boom that's going on there.
Yep.
On the other hand, China is a threat, as a potential a rival, but it's also a lot of the old language about cheap Asian labor is being revived. What do you make of the image of China in the American imagination today?
Well, you should probably know that when Bush first came into office, his advisor wanted to do China because they thought China was the biggest threat. In fact, stopped planning this whole Cold War era containment against China. Of course, that whole plan was scuttled because 9/11. But in the minds of many of these conservatives, neoconservatives particularly, China is still the biggest threat. Now, any time that U.S.-China relations worsen, one of the sure victim of Chinese Americans, and this is what I think it's quite worrisome because we don't necessarily just look at China, but we always somehow find ways to see the Chinese Americans as lack of loyalty or particularly at a time right now, there's a lot of interaction going on between China and the United States. A lot of people will be identified as not American and be victimized.
The fifth column threat.
That's right.
Thanks for joining us, Peter Kwong. I've been speaking with Peter Kwong, who is a professor at Hunter College at the CUNY Graduate Center and co-author, along with Dushanka Mischievich, of Chinese America, The Untold Story of America's Oldest New Community, just out from the New Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, and I will have an interview with Beverly Wright, who will be updating us on the sociology of New Orleans and its non-Reconstruction, apparently. And let's go out with the final two of the five orchestral pieces of Anton Webern, Anton Durati, and the London Symphony. Till next week. Goodbye.